When you walk into a museum and you see something behind glass, like a spinning wheel, or maybe an old telegraph machine, or even one of those giant early room-size
Right,
computers.
the ones that take up a whole wall.
Exactly. There's this implicit agreement you make with the object. You're looking at history, it's preserved, it's static, and, I mean, most importantly, it's safely in the past.
Yeah, it's categorized as an artifact. We put a little brushed steel placard next to it, and we just collectively agree that its time is over. And it's actually a very comfortable, almost comforting way to look at obsolescence
Yeah.
because the threat is gone.
Right, the threat is totally gone. But imagine looking into one of those glass display cases, and the thing staring back at you is, well, it's your own job.
Oh, man.
And
Yeah.
it's not 100 years in the future, it's a Tuesday. You are still very much alive, still trying to do the work, while the rest of the world just casually walks by and reads the placard explaining why you don't need to exist anymore.
Is the absolute definition of a living ghost.
It really is. And that is the exact nightmare that Howard Zimmering drops us into in his 2026 novel, Notes for a Future Reader.
Such a good book.
So good. And for you listening, welcome to the deep dive. Today we are exploring this book. It's set in 2034, which is just a few years from now. And in this world, AI has completely swallowed software engineering whole, just gone. And it is rapidly chewing its way through journalism, too.
Yeah, it's moving fast.
So the central conflict we are exploring today is basically what actually happens to a society when efficiency, this relentless metric of just being faster and cheaper, becomes the only way we measure the value of human work.
And it's a profound premise precisely because it strips away all that Hollywood sci-fi spectacle. Like, there are no robot uprisings here.
Right, no Terminators.
Exactly. No Terminators, no lasers. It's much quieter and far more insidious, really. It's about human dignity, about craftsmanship, and, what we lose when we decide to optimize every single friction point out of our lives.
So to really grasp how this plays out, we have to look at how Zimmering constructs this near-future reality. And he does this particularly through the character of Nadia Shin.
Yes, Nadia. She is fascinating.
She really is. She's a journalist at the Washington Herald, and she is the absolute picture of efficiency. Her entire life is optimized. Like, she eats microwave pad siu standing at the exact same spot at her kitchen counter every single night.
Totally frictionless.
Right. Her apartment is spotless, sterile, stripped of anything unnecessary. And her newsroom, I mean, it has shrunk from 120 people down to 31.
And the way the novel handles those empty desks is chilling, honestly, because it feels so economically realistic. They haven't just left empty chairs sitting there, they've rebranded the emptiness.
Ah, right, corporate speak.
Yeah. The vacant spaces are now called flex spaces and innovation hubs. And on the wall in the newsroom, there are these twin monitors. One shows the AI-generated articles constantly refreshing it, like in human speeds, and the other shows the human-written pieces just sort of trickling in.
And Nadia doesn't even look at the monitors anymore, right? She's completely emotionally detached. She has essentially optimized her own personality as a survival mechanism because she figures if she operates like an algorithm, efficient, frictionless, unfeeling emotion, maybe she won't be replaced by one.
Exactly. She's just surviving in a machine that is slowly starving her out.
Right.
And that psychological armor is so crucial to understanding her state of mind. When her editor, Sam, gives her a new assignment, she's told to profile a guy named Eli Sayer.
Eli.
Yeah, Eli is in his early 30s, and he is known as the last human coder in the DC area. He writes software from scratch, by hand,
Yeah.
in 2034.
Which, just to give context, in the timeline of the novel is 3 years after the coding profession was entirely automated out of existence.
Right, so he's an anomaly.
A total anomaly. And to prep for this interview, Nadia does something really telling. She visits a Smithsonian exhibit called The Age of Human Code. And this is where that museum glass case analogy from earlier becomes literal.
It's so on the nose, but it works so well.
It totally works. The museum treats human coding exactly like we treat, switchboard operators or lamplighters. They literally have a piece of human-written code on display, printed out on lined paper with irregular formatting and red pen notes in the margins.
And the placard calls these physical imperfections the hallmarks of handcrafted software.
Hallmarks. Wow.
Right. They've taken a living, breathing practice and just completely museumified it. They've declared the human code has absolutely no practical utility anymore. It only holds aesthetic or historical value. And Nadia, reading this placard, realizes society has already put Eli in a glass case while he's still walking around the city.
But look, playing devil's advocate here, isn't he just being stubborn? I mean, Nadia initially tries out this opening line for her article where she compares Eli to a monk in the Dark Ages illuminating manuscripts by candlelight.
Yeah, it's a very romantic image.
Sure, it's romantic, but ultimately, if a machine can write perfect, error-free code in 3 seconds, writing it by hand isn't romantic. It's just a refusal to accept reality. Like, why cling to the horse and buggy when the car is already in the driveway?
Oh, that is the trap.
Yeah.
The novel wants you to fall into that exact line of thinking. And Nadia falls into it, too, before she actually sits down with him. But when she finally interviews Eli, he completely refutes that framing.
Right, because he's not anti-technology.
Exactly. He isn't some Luddite protesting technology. Mm-hmm. He actually uses AI tools when it makes sense for mundane tasks. What he is fundamentally rejecting is the measurement of success. He gives Nadia this brilliant analogy. He compares AI-generated code to a microwave.
Oh, I love this part. He points out that, yes, a microwave is undeniably faster than cooking a meal on a stove. He doesn't argue with the speed or the efficiency. But he asks her, is speed the only thing that matters?
Right.
He refuses to accept that speed and cost are the only valid metrics for human endeavor.
Exactly. I mean, if cooking is purely about the biological necessity of getting calories into your bloodstream as fast as possible so you don't die, then the microwave wins every time.
No contest.
Right. But if cooking is about the process, the care, the specific intentional choices you make for the person you're going to sit down and eat with, well, then the microwave completely misses the point of the activity.
Okay, but if he's outright rejecting speed and cost as his guiding metrics, how does he even survive? What metric is he actually living by in that apartment? Because honestly, the contrast between Nadia's world and Eli's world is jarring.
It really is. Mm. We see that the moment she walks into his place in Adams Morgan. You mentioned Nadia's apartment earlier, right? Sterile, optimized. She has no photos on the walls except one that she keeps face down on her desk.
Which is so sad.
It is. But then Eli's apartment is the polar opposite. It's warm. It's cluttered with books stacked horizontally because he ran out of shelf space. It smells like cumin and old paperbacks.
He makes her pour over coffee by hand, grinding the beans with a manual hand crank, which takes forever. And he has a cat named Segfault who just sleeps on his keyboard.
Oh, yeah, Segfault.
Which, by the way, for anyone who doesn't code, a segmentation fault is a failure in memory access. It's basically when a program tries to read or write to an illegal memory location and just crashes. Naming the cat Segfault is this perfect, geeky inside joke.
It's so good.
It really shows his lingering, affectionate relationship with the nuts and bolts of machines, even the parts that break. His whole life is unapologetically human and messy.
And in the middle of this messy apartment, he shows Nadia what he's actually dedicating his time to. It's a library management app for a woman named Mrs. Patterson, who runs a small community center in Columbia Heights.
Right.
Now, Mrs. Patterson could have easily afforded the standard AI-generated software. It would have been virtually free. But she specifically sought out Eli.
And the thing that got me, like, the detail that absolutely shatters Nadia's professional, optimized attachment was the overdue notices.
Oh, the overdue notices.
He actually codes the automated system to say please and thank you. And he didn't just throw that in as a quirk. Mrs. Patterson specifically requested that tone. Because a machine can generate a notification instantly, but it can't mean please.
Right, the AI doesn't care if you bring the book back.
Exactly. Mrs. Patterson wants the system to ask the patron, person to person, to return the book so someone else can read it. That tiny, incredibly inefficient human friction of saying please is the entire reason the custom system exists.
And he takes this philosophy all the way down to the foundational architecture of the code itself. Nadia is looking over his shoulder at the screen, and she notices that his code is full of conversational comments left in the margins.
Like little notes to himself.
Kind of, but also for others. He explains in the code why a search function is deliberately programmed to be case insensitive. And it's specifically because a patron named Mr. Okoye types everything in all caps. Mrs. Patterson believes everyone, even someone who struggles with a keyboard, deserves to find their book.
That is so sweet.
It is. Eli leaves these notes for a future reader, this hypothetical coder, who might come along years later and wonder why the architecture was built this way.
Okay, but let's look at the mechanics of that for a second. The compiler, the actual machine translating that code into a working app, completely strips out those comments. It ignores them entirely. And Mrs. Patterson is certainly never going to look at the back-end database.
No, ever.
So why spend the hours typing that out? Like, what is the actual tangible value of leaving a piece of yourself in the work if literally no one ever finds it?
Well, the novel answers that by pulling back the curtain on Nadia's own hidden backstory. We finally learn about that face-down photograph on her desk at the newsroom.
Right, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, so her father, Jinsu Shin, was a master letterpress printer. He ran a small shop in Annandale that was slowly, agonizingly put out of business by faster, cheaper digital printing.
Classic story.
Right. And Nadia has this vivid memory of how her father used to hold a freshly printed page up to the light, and he would run his thumb over the text to physically feel the impression the lead letters made in the thick cotton paper.
I see. He was feeling for the depth of the care, because the digital printer just, like, sprays ink on the surface, but the letterpress actually bruised the paper. It left a physical mark of the effort.
That's the core of it. For Nadia's father, and for Eli, the value isn't just the final product being delivered to the consumer. It's the process of caring about the person on the receiving end.
Wow.
The argument Zimmering is laying out is that those inefficiencies, typing out the word please, formatting the code beautifully with marginalia, the physical impression of lead type on paper, the friction is exactly where human connection lives. When you optimize all the friction away to maximize speed and profit, you inadvertently optimize the humanity away too.
That makes so much sense. And Nadia finally sees this, doesn't she? She realizes Eli isn't a museum piece at all. He's just a guy who loves his mom and wants to help people in his community. She finds what she calls the blood in the machine.
Yes, the blood in the machine.
And because she is fundamentally a brilliant writer when she actually cares, she writes an incredible article. But this leads to the novel's darkest realization. It explores how modern society doesn't just ignore authenticity, it actively consumes it.
Oh, it's a devastating sequence to read, truly. Nadia writes the piece titled The Last Human Coder, and she just pours all of this truth into it. She includes the deeply private motivation behind Eli's work.
Right, about his mom.
Yeah, she reveals that he originally got into building apps not for clients, but to help his mother, Helen, who suffers from severe dementia. He built a custom birthday reminder app just to help her hold on to the crumbling architecture of her own life.
And the article goes massively viral. It breaks every engagement record at the Washington Herald. And the fallout is instantaneous and honestly terrifying. The world immediately digests Eli's private, quiet truth and regurgitates him as a symbol.
A symbol, yeah. A mascot, a weapon. I mean, we see a political activist named Marcus Webb get on camera and read Eli's deeply personal quotes like they are a political manifesto.
Yeah.
He's weaponizing Eli's life to fundraise for his own advocacy group. And within hours, protesters gather outside Eli's apartment building in Adams Morgan, holding up signs with quotes from Nadia's article. They are cheering for him, but they essentially trap him in his own home. He becomes a prisoner of his own virality.
Wait, let's look at the material reality of this for a second. Nadia did exactly what a great journalist is supposed to do. She told the truth, beautifully and empathetically. And because of that viral attention, a massive tech corporation called Evermark Meridian reaches out.
Right, the big bad tech corp.
Exactly. Their executive, Derek Langford, offers Eli a heritage developer residency. They want to pay him a massive salary to sit in a glass-walled studio at their corporate headquarters and write code for the public to watch. Now, we know from the story that Eli's mother's care facility has a $4,400 monthly gap that he currently cannot pay.
Yeah, he's drowning in debt.
He's facing a total crisis. This corporate job would solve all of his financial problems instantly. So isn't this a win? Like, the system actually worked for him.
Well, it looks like a win on a spreadsheet. But you have to look at why Evermark Meridian is actually making this offer. Derek Langford isn't some cartoon villain who wants to crush Eli. He genuinely liked the article. But the corporate structure he operates within only knows how to value Eli as a spectacle.
I see.
Evermark is a fully automated conglomerate. They want to wash their brand in the warm glow of human struggle. They want performative authenticity.
They are basically buying PR.
Exactly. They're buying good PR. If Eli takes the job, he stops being a man writing a library app for Mrs. Patterson. He becomes a man performing work for an audience, heavily mediated by a corporate legal department and a marketing team. Society in 2034 no longer values the human act of creating. It only values the spectacle of it.
Right. They want the show.
They want to watch the artisan sweat. They want to point at the struggle. But they don't actually care about the utility of the work itself.
That is so dark. And it hits so close to home with how we treat, you know, modern influencers or creators performing their quote-unquote authentic morning routines for an algorithm today.
Oh, absolutely.
It reminds me of a wildlife preserve or a zoo enclosure. The institution comes to you and says, hey, your natural habitat is completely destroyed, but we promise to keep you alive, safe, and well-fed. Hmm. The only catch is you have to agree to be put on display behind glass just so the institution can prove to the paying public that it still cares about nature.
That is the perfect analogy for the Heritage Developer Residency. It is a literal glass cage. And it brings us right to the climax of the story, where both of our main characters are forced to make a choice about their respective enclosures.
Okay, let's start with Eli. He is staring down this brutal November deadline where he will have to move his mother out of her specialized care facility and into a cheaper state-run shared facility 90 minutes away because he simply can't afford the rent.
Yeah, the stakes are incredibly high.
Very high. The corporate residency would fix this instantly. The money is right there on the table. But he rejects the offer.
He does. He runs the emotional arithmetic. He realizes that the residency pays for his mother's room by turning him into exactly what the dementia is, turning her into someone who is talked about, observed, and managed by others, rather than a person with agency.
Wow.
He refuses to let his mother's tragedy be used as corporate currency, and he refuses to be an exhibit in Evermark Zoo.
So how does he survive? Because rejecting the money doesn't magically make the bills go away.
Right. Well, he takes a quiet, totally unglamorous IT job fixing a legacy scheduling tool for a hospital system.
Wow. There is zero romance in that ending.
None whatsoever. But it's an honest ending. He sacrifices the romantic title of being the last coder to do the hard, necessary work of paying for his mother's care. But critically, he does it on his own terms, entirely outside of the public eye. He reclaims his privacy and his dignity. He refuses to perform his humanity for an audience.
And Nadia is faced with an eerily similar choice at the exact same time, isn't she?
She is.
Her editor, Sam, pulls her into his office. He tells her the rumor is true, the paper is being bought out by a media conglomerate, and the rest of the human writing staff is going to be replaced by algorithms. It's finally happening.
Yep, the other shoe drops.
But because her article on Eli drove unprecedented traffic, Sam offers her a protected lane. She can keep her job safe and highly paid, writing premium human interest pieces while the machines churn out everything else.
It is the exact same offer Evermark gave Eli. Sam is offering Nadia her very own glass case. She will be the resident human writer, kept on staff to prove the media conglomerate still has a heartbeat, while the actual newsroom dies completely around her.
And Nadia has spent her entire career turning human lives into content. She is the ultimate observer, the ultimate optimizer. Does she step into the cage?
She doesn't. Because she spent time with Eli, she finally sees the cage for what it really is. She realizes that her entire career, even her best, most empathetic writing, has been a way of standing in the doorway, watching life happen to other people without actually participating in it herself.
Mm-hmm.
She's been consuming their friction without risking any of her own. So she declines the buyout. She resigns from the Washington Herald.
She unplugs from the machine entirely.
Completely.
Yeah.
And the final scene of the excerpts we have is just breathtaking in its quietness. Nadia is sitting in her apartment late at night, but instead of typing an article on her laptop for an audience of hundreds of thousands of strangers, she takes out a heavy piece of cotton paper and a pen, and she writes a private letter to her deceased father.
By hand.
By hand. She tells him all about Eli. She writes that she finally understands why he stood by his printing press, running his thumb over the bruised paper on the day it shut down. And here's the most important detail. She leaves the mistakes in the letter.
Really?
Yes. She doesn't cross anything out. She doesn't use whiteout. She doesn't revise it to optimize the narrative flow. Mm. She just writes a true, messy thing for an audience of one, knowing full well her father will never even read it.
So when we step back and look at Zimmering's grand argument in Notes for a Future Reader, what is the ultimate takeaway for us?
I think the novel is warning us that when we optimize our world exclusively for speed and cost, we don't just eliminate hassle, we strip away the very friction where human connection actually happens.
Right.
The inefficiencies of our lives, the time it takes to say please, the effort to grind coffee by hand, the messy, unoptimized, heartbreaking process of caring for a sick parent that isn't waste. That is where our humanity lives. The story shows us that true dignity isn't found in being preserved as a symbol or a museum piece. It's found in doing the work, quietly and carefully, for the sake of another person, whether the world is watching or not.
It all comes back to that museum glass case we started with. The world wanted to put Eli and Nadia behind glass, to admire them as artifacts of a bygone era, to safely consume their authenticity. But they chose to break the glass and just live, friction and all.
Beautifully said.
Which leaves you, our listener, with a new question to ponder as you look at the creeping automation in our own world. We've talked a lot today about the value of human friction, the typos, the pauses, the physical effort. But consider this, what happens when algorithms become sophisticated enough to simulate that very friction?
Oh, wow. That's a scary thought.
Right. What happens when an AI learns to artificially insert a typo into an email just to seem more approachable, or artificially pauses before answering to simulate thought and care? If the machine can perfectly fake the blood in the machine, how will we ever know what's real, and does the origin of that friction still matter?
That is the next frontier, isn't it? When the machine learns to mimic the soul.
It really is something to think about the next time you get an unexpectedly warm, perfectly imperfect, automated message. Thanks for exploring Notes for a Future Reader with us. We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.